Hello and welcome to The Sound Off, a podcast where school safety takes center stage. My name is Michelle Gay, and I'm the co-founder and executive director of Safe and Sound Schools. We're committed to protecting every school and every student every day. And today, we're talking about the critical aspects of school violence prevention and creating a safe learning environment for students. Before we dive into our discussion, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for their support. This season of The Sound Off is brought to you by the Door Security and Safety Foundation, which advances the critical role of certified professionals in creating safe and secure building openings. For more information and to locate an expert, visit www.doorsecuritysafety.org. Joining me is Molly Hudgens, a passionate school counselor, researcher, and author with firsthand experience in recognizing red flags in at-risk students. Listen in as we debunk stereotypes and highlight the significance of fostering meaningful connections with students, creating a supportive environment, and building strong relationships with parents to ensure safe and sound futures. So welcome to The Sound Off, Molly Hudgens. I'm so excited about our conversation today.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Always fun, always exciting. The two of us together, it's a little dangerous, right?
Definitely. Especially if we have to record anything, right?
You just never know. I know you well, obviously, but I think lots of our listeners might be wondering, who's this Molly lady? And so it's always fun before we get into the real meaty stuff, the real weighty topics that we usually do, to start off with something a little silly. So I'm going to ask you to share a little superpower that you might have, something secret that maybe, or not so secret, but something that maybe folks would be surprised to know about Molly Hudgens, school counselor, author, mom, something that is unique and just fun to know about you.
Well, there's two things, and one of them, I'm not sure when I would ever need this, but I can recite all the prepositions in alphabetical order, thanks to my fifth grade English teacher. But the other one is that I learned that you can sing any of the works of poetry by Emily Dickinson to the tune of The Yellow Rose of Texas, Amazing Grace, or the theme from Gilligan's Island. So if you ever need me to do that, I will be available. I'm not sure how good it'll be. We might get booed, but I can do it. It can be done.
Those are two doozies. Wow. That's awesome. Oh my gosh. I'm a big fan of prepositions, I have to say, but it never occurred to me to memorize them all like in alphabetical order like that. I think I might need to take that on as a personal challenge.
There you go. I can help you.
Oh, that's so awesome. It's just the funniest thing what people share when we ask that question. And it's just always fun to know, everybody that we get to host on this podcast is really an expert in their own right in some area, some aspect of school safety. And sometimes we forget we're also people. Mm-hmm. We're also quirky, funny people. And those superpowers can be very telling about each and every one of us. So thank you for sharing. Thank you for playing. Super fun.
Oh, you're welcome.
Super
fun. You're welcome.
All right. So we're going to start this conversation about school violence prevention. It's an area of school safety that you and I are both deeply passionately committed to. I think it's fair to say that it's our life's work. A lot of that comes from our own lived experiences. And, I think sometimes you and I look at how this came to be and we're not quite sure, but it is where we are. And yet there's just a lot to understand about school violence prevention. So I think before we dive into the conversation, let's establish some common ground. What is really some common knowledge about school violence and school violence prevention that we want all of our listeners to know before we start this journey together?
When you think about school violence, some people think of just mass situations that involve lots of people. Other times there's school violence that occurs that's targeted, or there are only one or two people involved. So I think that's one of the challenges we face when we address school safety, is trying to encompass all of it, from a smaller scale situation to one that obviously would be larger scale and affect more people. So that's one of the things that I kind of think of, is the challenge that we face with that issue.
I would agree. I mean, think about violence is pretty broad. And even if you want to specify school violence, we've got gang violence. We've got, you know, domestic situations sometimes that unfortunately more often than I think we would like to see, or even that gets reported in a lot of our schools. Lots of, you know, there's fighting in the hallways. There's all kinds of different forms of violence, bullying, assault, things like that. So when we're talking about school violence and the particular aspects of it that you are most dedicated to, I think, what would those be?
For me, the focus is on making the kids feel safe in the school and making the families and the staff understand that we're putting every preventative measure in place for that safety to happen. And that while a lot of that safety does involve securing our perimeter and focusing on the logistics within the building and the specifics of your campus, we are also working within the school with the resources that we have, with the staff we have available to us, to learn as much as we can about our students, to see who is struggling, to find out what types of interventions we need to put in place. So it's definitely multifaceted in that you're not just looking at this from an outside perspective. You're also trying to look at it from the inside out to try to determine ways that you can make safety available to everyone, and teaching the students and their families how to share when they're concerned about something that's happening in the school or something that has already happened, or if there's a student in particular that they have a concern about. I think sometimes it's finding ways for that communication to happen. There are a lot of people who would and want to share and report things, but sometimes they're just not sure if it's valid, or they're not sure who they can share that with, who will listen and understand. So it's providing a way for communication to happen and for everyone to be able to share what they know in order for us to determine whether or not we have a serious threat that is going on, or a child that needs intervention, or if this is something that needs to involve a different entity, maybe outside of ours. So as you said already, there's just a lot of pieces to this, and making sure that everyone who is working on the puzzle knows that their piece matters, but also that we have to figure out where it fits is sometimes, again, a challenge.
You know, what does school violence mean to you? School violence prevention, what are we talking about here?
Well, for me within the school, it really is more about focusing on students that we have concerns about, either concerns that have been brought to us by someone outside of the school, or a student or a staff member or a family member, or even the child themselves. And a lot of times we'll have parents who'll reach out as well and say, I have a concern about my child. So when I'm thinking about the school violence piece, I think about the individual students in our building and protecting them, but also protecting them not just from outside situations, but also from themselves in some cases. And so I think about that involving our threat assessment team, and that involving all of our administration and our SRO and even our school nurse. I think about all the people who play a role when we are concerned about a situation, whether that, again, is something going on inside of the school or outside.
So it may not even be that we're dealing with actual violence, you know, it may just be sort of red flags, as you have said in some of your trainings, warning signs, or just even concerns, you know, this student is not acting like themselves lately, or seems down, a peer speaking up about a concern that they have, something they heard or they saw, a worry that they have about one of their peers or their classmates, right?
Yes, definitely. And even, you know, I think of the things like reports that come in about possible self-harm or students who have suicidal ideation. There's all those pieces. And sometimes that doesn't come straight to a teacher or an administrator. It comes to the counselor. It comes to the nurse. And so it's figuring out how for that information to be communicated to the people who can help, the people who are most available and have the most resources to meet the need of that child. And again, that is if we're talking about looking at this from the inside out. And I think that that's really important to do, because it gives the kids a way to know that we care about them and that they have a trusted adult in the building with whom they can share concerns.
So proaction versus reaction whenever possible.
Every time.
I think too, when we talk about things like school violence prevention, there are also, unfortunately, there's just a lot of room for misunderstanding, a lot of misconceptions and myths, so to speak. When you are teaching a class, when you're talking about this work, what are some of those myths and misconceptions that you find you're running into quite a bit in the field?
Well, I think that a lot of people take cues from what they see or they read about in the media or in the press in some way, and they assume that people who are going to commit an act of violence fit some type of stereotype, or there is some type of formula that you could use to discern who is actually going to commit violence versus who just seems like they might. And so I think for me, it's reminding people that we're looking at not what we think someone is like, but behavior that they have exhibited. So we look at students who have done something or said something versus just the ones that seem like they could. So it's important that you look at what they are saying to people around them, what they are posting on social media, how they are interacting with their friends. And when we recognize what I call uncommon behavior, because I've spent 25 years working with kids this age, if they're exhibiting something that doesn't seem as if it is common behavior for a child their age or their grade level, that's when we become a little more concerned and we may intervene differently.
What you're saying is that sort of age-old image of the young boy in the dark hoodie skulking along on the internet or something, that's not really what we're talking about here. We're really talking less about what somebody looks like and more about how they are behaving, what actions that are kind of out of the ordinary we're seeing from an individual.
Exactly. Because I think it's really unfair to look at a child and just make assumptions based on something they are wearing or the way that we perceive them. You know, not everyone who commits an act of violence in a school is a loner. Not everyone was bullied. But a lot of those ideas have been fashioned over time and I think have been revisited over and over. And yes, in some cases, kids who have been violent on campus have had some of those experiences. But we can't say that that's happened to every one of them every time. A lot of times when people look at these kids, you can't just assume that they are loners or that they are because they're not in an inner circle or they're quieter or they wear dark colors or they seem sad, that automatically makes them a candidate to become violent in the future. That's not the case. Some kids are introverts. Their personality is a little different. And sometimes they don't want to be part of the activities at the pep rally. Sometimes they would rather sit in the cafeteria and read a book or draw a picture. And that doesn't make their behavior wrong. And so I think sometimes we have to remind people that we definitely need always to check in with kids that we feel like are trying to isolate or keep themselves separate from others, but we can't just assume that they're going to be a danger to themselves or anyone else. I do think one of the issues is not just looking at a kid and making assumptions. It's getting to know them, looking at all the information we have about them, and then trying to determine whether or not they do need some type of intervention. And that means that we have to look at our kids, too, who are the most outgoing, who have a wide circle of friends, who are very involved in sports or activities, because those kids are struggling, too, sometimes, and have just become very good at covering up how they're feeling. It's important that we get to know them as best we can in our school setting in order to determine if they do need help and giving them a place to come if they need it.
I love that. So really considering the context, it sounds like, is really important. Looking at the big picture, knowing that baseline, what's normal for this individual. And if it is normal that they are shy, then that's what we would expect, right? So really rethinking that piece. But I love what you just added there about the trusted adult. Every kid needs that introvert, extrovert, athlete, science star, whatever it is about any child that sort of defines them for that moment in their life. Let's face it, they're growing and changing, you know, very rapidly. We do need to recognize that every one of them needs at least one trusted adult that they can come to, they can confide in, they can go to when they're in need.
Very true. It's difficult because you're trying to respect their space And I work with teenagers. And so you know that sometimes their demeanor can appear that they have an attitude or they're just downtrodden. And really, when you get a chance to talk to them privately, maybe they just are having a rough week or whatever. So I think it's allowing them to be respected within their space, but also letting them know that we're here, we're present when you're ready, if you want to talk or you need to. And I've been surprised at the times we've had kids who have not initially wanted to talk or who have felt like they didn't really have anything going on, but someone had been concerned about them, who then returned later and said, hey, actually, I think I really do need to talk about something. Sometimes it's knowing when to give a little push and when to pull back and just wait for them. And if they really think you care about them and they really think that it's a safe, private place for them to talk, they come back almost every time if they need to.
Well said. And that relates really powerfully to a particular experience of yours that you wrote a book about a student for whom you opened that door and you allowed that student to come in and leave of their choosing. And yet that student came back to you at the moment. I know it's hard to kind of encapsulate that story in the short span that we have, but talk about the power of that relationship and the power of opening the door and how that literally saved your school community.
Well, I feel like in order to tell that story, I really have to go back and think about the week before our averted school shooting when there was another student who intervened. He is really the one who I think is probably the greatest hero in this because he realized he had a friend who was struggling, who was going through a lot of different things at one time. And any one of those things really in and of itself would not have been something extremely overwhelming. But those things had all kind of spun together and this kid saw his friends sort of unraveling. And he came to me. He had met with me before. He'd had a loss in his family and we had worked together some. And he just came and said, Ms. Hudgens, you know, you always tell us if we're worried about one of our friends to let you know. And I have this friend that I'm worried about. And so because of this first child's willingness to stand in the gap for his friend, I met with a young man who would the next week be involved in our situation. And that conversation I headed into with some hesitancy because I knew that the child was not coming of his own volition. He was coming because I was calling him down and I knew his guard would be up. And it was that Friday when I first met with him. But after a while, I think he started to feel some relief at being able to share all these problems that he was going through, all this, these things that had been happening to him. And you know, so he talked that day for about 45 minutes. And then the next week on Wednesday morning, when I least expected him to show up, that is when he came to me again and shared with me that he had a plan to harm people on our campus. He had a firearm. So he obviously had the victims, he had the means, and he certainly had the opportunity. But something inside of him said, I think I need to go to somebody for help. And he told me, you know, Ms. Hudgens, I came to you because I think you're the only person that can talk me out of this. And it reminded me the power of that one conversation the week prior, as well as the classroom guidance lessons I had done with the kids, which is where they got to know me as a person and where we got to have conversations and got to talk about mental health and physical safety and everything that we discussed in those lessons during the year, drug and alcohol prevention, all of those things. And it had painted a picture so that they knew I cared about them. And he realized from having the conversation the week before that I was invested in him specifically because I had been willing to have that long conversation. So I think about how we hear a lot about relationships matter, and I know that that is true, but I believe with all my heart, with not only kids, but with adults, that in order for a relationship to be established, it has to be genuine. I jokingly say often that kids are like dogs. They smell fear and fake. You know, they know when someone doesn't really have their best interest at heart or is listening but not really paying attention. And he knew that I actually cared. And I think that piece of it, that rapport that was created unbeknownst to me really the week prior, turned out to be our saving grace.
Amazing. They smell fear and fake. You're 100% right. You got to show up fully for our kids in order for it to count. Based on what you shared, you know, folks that are new to you and your story probably understand how it is that you you came or you could have come to be an expert in school violence prevention. But I know better. I know more. I know this started a long time ago. This is a passion, a fire that was lit in your heart years and years and years before this fateful day, this time with this student. Can you share a little bit about how it happened that a school counselor became an expert before even this day or this story in school violence prevention?
Well, in 1999, when the school shooting happened at Columbine, I became very interested in the story, not because I wanted to know all the details that I thought the public wanted to know, really, but I couldn't wrap my mind around how two boys had created a plan of that magnitude over a year's time and then carried it out without anyone recognizing something was not right. And so I started wondering, are there similarities when you look at acts of school violence historically? And so I started researching in 1999 as many of the acts of school violence as I could find on campuses that had information provided from psychologists, from psychiatrists, from mental health professionals, from law enforcement. And I started looking for those specific people because I knew that there would be research behind that and that there had been enough time established since the events that I felt like it would probably be fairly accurate. And I thought, if I have a student in my classroom who has similar tendencies or displays similar mannerisms or behaviors, could I find that child and could I help them? Could somebody help them in time? And so I spent 10 years doing that research and wrote a training during the course of that called Recognizing Red Flags and Educators' Role in Preventing School Violence. And I traveled all over and talked to anybody in the world who would listen to me, mostly law enforcement and juvenile court, about this. And it was an in-depth psychological analysis of school shooters. And what I found is that the more that I read and the more that I learned, I would notice things in the writings of students that concerned me, and I could pull the child aside and just have a conversation in the hallway. This is even before I was a counselor. So he gave me opportunities, and then I could talk to their parents and just say, you know, I feel like maybe your child's going through a hard time right now, or I've just got some concerns. And because I had formed a rapport with the family and with the child, they were receptive to those conversations and a lot of times even relieved that somebody was listening. When I think back on that, I really spent 18 years, but it wasn't just researching that. It was having conversations with hundreds and hundreds of kids in a classroom setting, later in a counseling setting. I had been counseling for about 12 years when this incident happened. And so I had had a chance to talk to a lot of kids in crisis, to kids who were struggling. And so all of those things, I think, were part of this process. But I also think about, as there were other acts of violence that occurred, how that had such a profound effect on me. And I really couldn't understand why. I was never and have never been directly connected to any act of mass violence on a school campus other than our averted incident. But every time one of those would happen, I would be devastated. And I would think about all of the people involved in that and how far out that ripple would go and how long they would experience hurt from that. And it's just almost as if it reminded me to dig in and pay attention and ask questions and sometimes have uncomfortable conversations with kids, because I did want them to feel like someone was listening, because it did seem to me that in the case of a lot of these perpetrators, they didn't feel heard for whatever reason. And their act was a way for them to speak. And so I was just determined to give these kids an avenue in which to express themselves. And sometimes that didn't come through verbal language. Sometimes it was through writing. Other times it was through art. Again, all these pieces I had learned from these various acts, I drew from. I think I still do that. Even today, I work very closely. All of our teachers who teach writing in some way, there's things that they're made aware of. You know, they understand if I read something that bothers me, I need to talk to Molly about it. The same thing with our art teacher, because I know that kids at this age are still more likely to be honest and express exactly what's going on. While the older they get, the more they recognize what behaviors are taboo and they start to try to cover those up. And we don't want that to happen. if a child is having hallucinations or delusions, we want them to tell us, and we want them, you know, for us to not react as if we're shocked or appalled, but to be welcoming to that conversation and remind them that we can find a way to help. And that's happened many times. And seeing kids and the look on their face when they realize Miss Hudgens believes me and she's going to help me figure out what to do. Like there is, it is literally like you can see it. And so for me, there was definitely the preparation of the research, which still continues for me. I still read everything that I just finished reading not too long ago, the law enforcement after action report from the shooting at Uvalde, because I want to understand what happened so that I can think about my own school and how we could learn from what went wrong or what we could have done differently in some of these situations. And so for me, it's a lifelong learning process. I think that's partly because I'm a teacher, but I still want to know what are new practices. And Michelle, you know that like a lot of times when we go to conferences, we may be there to present, but I'm like, let's stay and listen to this person because I know I want to hear the scenarios and figure out what people did and how they handled that, because that's things I can still take back and use. So to me, some of the best research that I have ever done or will ever do and continue to do is in the trenches, still doing the same job. And I love it. And I feel like I'm helping somebody.
100%. That makes you an expert practitioner. I love how you said lifelong learner. If our hearts and our minds stay open when we're working with kids in schools, they're really the ones doing all the teaching. We're teaching lots of life skills, navigation skills, as I like to say, providing them with things that they're going to need to be successful in life. That's why we signed up for this, right?
Yep.
But the reality is they have so much to teach us, and what it does for a child and for their family. You know, you pointed out how important it is that the family has that level of trust with at least one adult in the school building that they feel they can bring a concern to, or that if a concern is brought to them, they're going to be receptive to that conversation. That can potentially be a game changer. And yet that's one of the most difficult things. We know historically that can be one of the most challenging things, is really trying to incorporate parents into the conversation in a way that's non-threatening, that becomes cooperative, that, you know, it's clear that we're all on the same team. We're all on the team of your child.
And I think sometimes one piece of that is every parent, whether we will ever admit it or not, has a fear of people thinking that we're not a good parent. And I think sometimes that's what we face when we try to have these conversations. And you mentioned, you know, not wanting the parents to feel defensive. And it's saying, listen, we love your kid too. When your child comes on our campus, they're our child. I'm the protector. I'm the mama bear force, you know, here at school. And so reminding them, hey, you may not know that this behavior that your child is exhibiting is uncommon. This may be your first child. It may be your only child. And your assumption is that this is something that every 13-year-old does or whatever. So we're not here to try to say that you're doing anything wrong at home. None of this is your fault, but there is a struggle going on with your child. And we want to figure out how we can help not only you as a parent, but us as a staff and your child as a person. I can tell sometimes when we have those conversations that parents are hesitant to say very much. It's almost like there's a fear of, what are you going to do if I give you this information? You know, and so it's helping them understand, just like you said, we're not looking to give a child a consequence. This is not a punishment situation. If we're reaching out to have a support meeting, it is not because they're in trouble. We just realize there are some things that we need to address. And I love when they do start to open up, parents, and they share more about what they're seeing at home. Because they do sometimes seem relieved when they realize that we're seeing the same behaviors at school and that there may be an underlying cause and that we can work together to try to support the child through whatever their situation may be. But some of that, fortunately for me, comes from years of experience in the same school and in the same community with the same parents and being able to have conversations that might be more difficult if I were a new counselor or if I was new at a school system or setting. And so some of those things take time. And so we have to be patient, too, as we acclimate ourselves into the school setting if we're new to that or to a new position, and just realize that, yet again, this is where the relationships are going to matter. where the parents are going to see you show up for choir concerts or basketball games or the debates that are going on. And they're going to see that you care about their child more than just during the time frame in which that you have them at school. So a lot of moving parts in that connecting everyone piece.
That's good advice, though, because as we talk about the ideals, right, we have to be realistic and recognize that a newly minted school counselor or classroom teacher or school nurse or, you know, whatever role it is you find yourself in the school building, it takes time to create those relationships. You kind of got to prove yourself to the students. So great, great advice. That has been the Sound Off from Molly Hudgens. Wonderful to spend some time together. We do get to spend a lot of time together, but this kind of time is precious, and I really do enjoy every moment of it with you. So thank you for joining us today and helping us to think about what it is that we can do in our own schools and communities to make sure that everybody is safe and sound. We hope you enjoyed this powerful episode of The Sound Off with Molly Hudgens. Thank you to our season sponsor, the Door Security and Safety Foundation, for supporting this podcast. And thank you all for listening and supporting our mission at Safe and Sound Schools. Remember, school safety is a collective responsibility, and together we can make a difference. Subscribe now to The Sound Off to stay informed and be part of the movement for safer schools. Until next time, everybody stay safe and sound.